This is Amarins.
Hey, Arthur. This is Eric from Confessions of a Southern Boy in Yankee Land. I am a horrible human being. I have no excuse, no matter how busy I am, for forgetting to call and wish you a happy 50th and a happy 12th. I just finished listening to show 50, and I am very, very happy for you. Congratulations on both of those accomplishments. I'm looking forward to, well, 50 more and 12 more. Take care. Hope you're doing really well.
Hi everybody, this is Arthur, a gay American now living in New Zealand, and welcome to episode 51 of the Amarins podcast for Tuesday, November 6th, 2007. I'm joined today by a special guest, someone I've been trying to get on the podcast for a long time now, and when we actually recorded, we had a long and wide-ranging conversation, and I originally intended on dividing it into two parts because I felt it was too long, sort of like the Preacher's Kid episode. But also like that episode, I decided in the end that the conversation just flowed on from one thing to another, and it didn't make sense to just try to arbitrarily cut it. And in any case, I think you're perfectly capable of just stopping and restarting, so I don't really need to make that decision for you. So that's going to be the bulk of this episode today. I'll be back at the very end with the usual contact details, but comments I'm again going to hold off until the Friday episode. So here now is my special guest. Joining me now is Mark, who is the author of one of my favorite websites that I've mentioned many times, called Slap Upside the Head. Hello, Mark, and welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, why don't we start with you describing basically what Slap Upside the Head is?
Okay, well, where to start? Basically, it's an anti-homophobia blog that I have. It's focused on Canada, because that's where I live. And you know, it's one of those things that I didn't even really start off with any grand plan. I was reading articles, I think it was in the middle, Canada's legalized same-sex marriage, and there was this huge debate leading up to that. And every day in the media, the newspapers, on TV, we were just bombarded with messages. You know, some were positive, but it's mostly the negative ones that stuck out for me. And I tried to cope with it maybe by writing some letters to the editor, but, you know, they're not always accepted, and they edit them for space, and I didn't really feel like I was able to get my opinion out there. So I didn't actually start the blog then, but that's when I started thinking about it, and it was until after same-sex marriage was legalized, you know, that's not the end of things. People are still kind of attacking you, and I figured, why not? I'll start this now.
Okay. And I've noticed that, well, you've subtitled the blog, Combating Bigotry the Gayest Way I Know How, which I think is actually quite funny. And I suppose we should probably tell the people, we're talking here about metaphorical slaps, aren't we?
Oh, yeah, no. When I came up with the name, I thought, you know, maybe I shouldn't choose something so violent, but I thought of the name after the last election, which I wanted to go up to everyone who voted for the Conservative Party and slap them upside the head, and I was going to call that Operation Slap Upside the Head, just kind of jokingly. And I thought, you know, that's an okay name. But yeah, no, it's metaphorical slaps. I think I have a little disclaimer on the
yes.
side, just kind of jokingly referring to that.
That never hurts to point that out. Now, you live in Montreal now, or however you say that. Say it for me.
Oh, in English, just Montreal?
Yeah.
in French, they don't pronounce the T. It's more like Montréal.
Yeah. Yes, long-time listeners might recall that Mark tried valiantly to coach me on how to pronounce that correctly in an earlier episode, and I didn't entirely get it. He was gracious enough not to point that out. But so where did you grow up originally?
I grew up in Alberta. It was a suburb of Edmonton, which is the capital of Alberta. The suburb's not the capital. St. Albert is where I grew up. Edmonton's the capital. I moved to Calgary, which is the second large city in Alberta. I'm trying to think when that was. I think maybe about 2001. And then I moved here to Montreal about a year and a half ago now.
Okay.
So, yeah, no, it hasn't been too much moving. I guess I haven't really traveled as far as you have. But it's still, I should mention Montreal is in Quebec, which is the French-speaking part of Canada. So it is kind of like going to a whole new culture for me, which is pretty exciting. I really like it here.
Yeah, and yet you still get to be in Canada, so the best of both worlds.
Well, that's the thing, you know, all the laws are the same. you know, I don't need new citizenship. Finding work is no problem. Well, I shouldn't say that. Unless you're fluent in French, finding work is going to be a problem. But I'm getting there.
I actually have visited Montreal. It was sometime in the year before I left to come to New Zealand. I can't remember exactly which month. It was the off season, though, I can tell you that. But I was struck by how foreign and yet familiar it was, because I'd been to other parts of Canada, English-speaking Canada. And one of the things I first noticed, though, was I went to some little shop to pick up something. Oh, I had a cold, that's what it was. I went to get some cold medicine. And the clerks first started talking to me in French and then in English. And when I responded in English, then she carried on in English only. And I thought that was fascinating. They don't assume that anybody speaks one language, or didn't at the time anyway, assume that people spoke one language or the other. I thought it was fascinating.
In fact, whenever you walk into a store, they almost always say something like, "Bonjour, hi." And whatever your response is going to be the response that they switch to.
Yeah.
You know, even though Quebec overall is a French province, it's their official language. They even have some people might even consider heavy-handed laws to try and get people to speak French. One of the examples people keep bringing up is signage. If you see a sign on the street, French has to be bigger than English. You can't have any sign that has equal sizes. It just one has to be dominant, and that's always French. You have to have a certain number of French employees, I believe, in a business. But Montreal itself is a bilingual city, and especially in the downtown area, you're not going to have any trouble speaking one or the other.
Yeah, well, being a big city, I imagine, is probably more cosmopolitan than some of the more rural areas might be.
Well, that's what drew me toward it. I mean, don't get me wrong, there are, I mean, Edmonton and Calgary are nice-sized cities. They're about 1 million people each. They're not huge, but the Alberta mentality, which we always kind of refer to it as the Texas of Canada.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I haven't been to Texas. I don't want to make any snap judgments, but it is very conservative if you look at the population, you know, even socially conservative. Maybe in comparison to the States, it's probably not as conservative, but it's still, compared to the rest of the Canada, definitely. So, you know, that wasn't really a big fit for me. I wanted to be somewhere bigger, but also culturally different. So somewhere like Toronto, I didn't really think of much.
Mm-hmm. There's some big annual event in Calgary, isn't there? I can't think off the top of my head what it is.
The Stampede.
That's it.
I call it the Hick Pride Festival. You know, it's funny because it's world known in some respects. I mean, you knew about it. And whenever I go to it, I can't see it as being that big of a deal. It's like any other kind of traveling fair. Like Edmonton had what was called the Klondike Days. It's changed its name now, and I can't remember what it's called. But it's all the same stuff. These, I don't know if other parts of the world have it, but there's this company called Conklin, and they make these kind of fairground rides that you can disassemble and move around the country. And that's all the Stampede really is to me. They also have a rodeo aspect to it, which maybe that's what people go to most. But, you know, I don't see it as much special going on, so, you know.
Yeah, I think one of the things, one of the reasons why it stuck in my mind is I saw a documentary once about some gay rodeo people, and they were either were talking about it or going to it or something like that. I wish I could remember the details now, but it's been quite a while ago that I saw it.
Okay.
But anyway. Now, Edmonton, wasn't that where Wayne Gretzky played?
It was, yeah, for the Edmonton Oilers.
Yeah.
That was during my youth. I guess it was kind of the mid-80s.
Yeah. Then didn't he marry an American and move south of the border?
He did, yeah. Edmontonians were pretty upset about that, I think. But,
yeah.
You know, growing up in Canada, I'm supposed to be all about hockey and loving it. But, and, you know, when people get very excited about it, if a Canadian team makes it into the NHL playoffs or something, maybe I'll watch a little bit. But I was never as much into that. My parents tried to get me to go into hockey pretty young. And I was in skating lessons. We would go to a mall, it was a big mall called West Edmonton Mall. They have a big skating rink. And during one of these lessons, I can't remember exactly what happened because I was pretty young, but I fell somehow, and the strap that held my helmet in place actually ended up cutting my throat, which I didn't really know that it was. I mean, it didn't like sever my jugular and whatever. but apparently it was pretty horrifying to look at, and I didn't really feel it. I don't know if it was the coldness or whatever, so I was fine. I kept skating for a little bit, and people just looked horrified, and eventually I was escorted off the rink, and it wasn't until I walked past one of these mirrored pillars while my parents were freaking out trying to find the medical center that I saw my reflection, and of course immediately started crying, and I think that's the last thing I remember. I just kind of blanked out after that. I don't think I went unconscious, but I don't remember anything after that.
It was probably the brain protecting you.
Yeah, but that was the end of my hockey career.
Yeah. It's enough to scare anybody away, I would think.
Well, you know, I think I would still enjoy skating. I really should get back into that.
Well, in New Zealand, of course, the sport that would be probably most analogous to that would be rugby, which once upon a time was a very big deal. I mean, every school child played that, and everyone followed the local teams and, of course, the national team, the All Blacks. But it's been waning in recent years. Ever since it went professional, the attendances have been down, and people just aren't following it so much anymore. And at the school level, in many areas, kids are playing soccer now, which other people call football, because it's not being a supposedly non-contact sport. Parents see it as safer than rugby.
Okay. Yeah, I was put in soccer, too.
Yeah. I actually was never very interested in that either, but...
Well, as I recall, my parents used to take me to 7-Eleven or somewhere to get a treat every time I kicked the ball, so I don't think I was very good either.
Oh, well. Although you can say that there are a higher proportion of very good-looking soccer players than there are, say, American football players. But
yeah, possibly. Maybe that's why I don't like hockey so much. Everyone's always padded up, and you know, it's not like the shorts and short sleeves kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Canada and America, of course, Canada has an image throughout the world, really, especially because of the distinctive red and white flag and the maple leaf. But it must be sort of frustrating, I guess, to live next door to a country that is so culturally overpowering and obviously better known, but I mean, is it something that Canadians often talk about or think about, being so, I don't want to use the word overshadowed because it makes it sound like Canada doesn't do anything, but to be so dominated, I suppose, by such a big neighbor?
Well, you know, I've never really saw that as a problem. I've been to the States many, many times, and, you know, I don't like when people assume I'm American. I guess, you know, it's probably the same thing between New Zealand and Australia.
Yeah.
If someone detects the accent. But other than that, you know, there are certain parts of their culture that it's kind of a shame that it takes over other parts of our culture as well. But, yeah, I've never really felt, at least overtly, overshadowed. Maybe on the international stage, you know, whenever something happens in the States, it will get a lot more attention. I don't really know if whenever our prime minister does something, if it really makes any kind of news. But, you know, that's something that hasn't really bothered me. And I found out when I went to Europe for a while, it was only about a month. But I don't know. It gave me this perspective that before I was a little maybe more defensive about the distinction between Canada and the U.S. But after going there, I just kind of realized, you know, in the same way that I see a lot of Europe is kind of mostly the same, I think people view North America kind of like that. And when they say, you know, you must be American, it's not that they're more associating me with the States. I think they just think of North America as kind of this big thing. And certainly, of course, the States has a bigger presence and they're, you know, it's more of a superpower by far. Mm. But, yeah, no, I've never felt really overshadowed.
Oh, that's good. Glad to hear
that.
Yeah,
and I can't really explain why. And I don't want to speak for everyone either, because some people do get really defensive. I know that whenever they travel, they put Canadian flag patches all over their clothes and backpacks. And,
yeah.
Maybe it's just me. I don't really care as much.
Although I suppose in this day and age, having a little Canadian flag on your person is probably a bit of safety if you're traveling in certain countries anyway.
Well, it probably can be. I think a lot of the reaction, at least this is just from my experience when I went to Europe, is whenever I mentioned I was Canadian, you know, having the Canadian flag on your backpack or something, I guess, is so common that people were actually asking me, why don't I have it? Because they always see it as something very odd. Like, why would someone put their country's flag on it when they go? You know, I think it's more because we don't want to be mistaken for Americans, because politically, you know, maybe we'd be treated a little different. But yeah, no, that's probably more of an issue now. Actually, when I did go to Europe, it was shortly after the war in Iraq started. And really, the only experience I had that made me feel a little uncomfortable was when talking to someone from the States. I was just in an elevator, and he must have detected my accent, and he asked, "Oh, what part of the States are you from?" And I said, "Well, actually, I'm from Canada." And he kind of got this, "Oh, Canada," kind of look. And then he didn't talk to me anymore. And the elevator was all going up. And I went, "Yeah, I'm from Alberta. It's just above Montana." And, you know, I got enough of the cold looks back. He didn't want to continue the conversation. I know at the time the war was very popular in the States, and it was never popular in Canada. We have troops in Afghanistan right now. And that's kind of a big issue kind of locally here. We're trying to figure out whether or not, you know, with more and more soldiers being killed, if they should be brought home or if they should stay there. But we never supported the war in Iraq, and I think rightfully so. So there was some contention there. I don't know if that's why the guy wasn't talking to me, but...
It very well could have been. New Zealand is in the same situation. It opposed the Iraq war, but still has troops in Afghanistan. I'm sure it's not as many as Canada has, because they're mostly specialists of one sort or another. But there's been zero support, well, not zero, but very little support for the Iraq war among New Zealanders generally. And that hasn't changed. If anything, the opposition as it has in the U.S. as well, I suppose, has grown stronger as the war's gone on.
Yeah. Well, I find that's kind of happening everywhere. Like, even in the States, I think support for President Bush is something like in the 20-something percent now.
Yeah.
The thing is, though, I mean, our conservative party here, we actually have a conservative government now. It's been that way for a while. It's a minority government, which I think you probably talked about in one of your previous podcasts.
Briefly.
About what that is, yeah. But it kind of surprised me, because they supported the war in Iraq, and if they were in power at the time, Canada would be in Iraq, too. So right now, having a minority government, it feels kind of very... Yeah, some kind of precarious situation where I really don't know what's going to happen in the next election. And I think that's the kind of thing maybe that doesn't get much news coverage, and that kind of thing maybe feels a little overshadowed by what the States is doing, because Canada right now is at the point where we might have a change. Like, we had a change in government. We have a conservative minority, but if they ever got a majority, and that could happen in the next election, then our policies would all shift, and maybe we would send soldiers to Iraq. I know the conservatives are very much against withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. But yeah, who knows what's going to happen? It's something that I'm keeping an eye on. I'm not too sure how much the rest of the world knows about it or cares, really. I guess you can't pull up politics in every country.
No. And that's actually one of the reasons why, when the Canadian Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, for the benefit of Americans who may not know who he is, was in Canberra speaking to the Australian Parliament, why I played a little clip on my podcast. Because I certainly think that most people in the U.S. probably don't know anything about Canadian politics. I think that's fair to say. But also, it struck me when I was listening to his speech, and I said this in the podcast, how the comparisons he was drawing between Canada and Australia were far more apt between Canada and New Zealand, because Australia has massive differences from Canada, I think, particularly in areas like dealing with original inhabitants, first and foremost, but also in other areas as well. It's just that I think perhaps the conservative elements in Canada want there to be more commonality with the current conservative government in Australia than there really is. But that's just my two cents, because I honestly don't know what that was all about. But
I think that makes two of us.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the things, I really don't like Stephen Harper, and it's for more than just the conservative policies, but he tends to do a lot of attacking of... He always refers to the Conservative Party as Canada's new government. It's always, Canada's new government is doing this, the new government is doing that. It's been, I don't know exactly how long now, but it's been something like 2 years, just about. You know, they're not a new government anymore. And even when on the international stage, when making a speech, I don't remember if this was the case with the Australian one, but I would wager that it probably was, that he would have mentioned something about the former Liberal government not doing something, or if there's any problem, he always has to apologize because it was the former Liberal government's fault. And It's those kind of little jabs that I just feel have no place on the international stage, at least. If you want to debate it when we have question period and everyone's yelling at each other and it's all theatrics, that's fine. But when we're supposed to be representing the country somewhere else, I do think it's a little over the top.
Yeah.
So I don't like him because he seems to do that a lot more than any other former prime minister that I can think of anyway. When, you try and play up the similarities, and of course you want to win over some people in whatever the host country is that you're making a speech. But for the most part, I think these kind of speeches, like the one in Australia, is mostly meant for Canadians. I'm not even too sure how much attention it got over in Australia.
I don't either. Well, I suppose I wouldn't because I don't live there. But I do know that it was carried live on one of the news channels, 24-hour news channel called Sky News, which is owned ultimately by Rupert Murdoch because it's just the local affiliate of the B Sky B operation that he has in Britain.
He owns everything.
Oh, he does. He owns a huge chunk of the media. Although not all of the biggest papers in Australia are owned by him, fortunately, and he only has a minority shareholding in anything here in New Zealand so far. So far, so good. switching back to Canada specifically, I would say this is my observation. You can certainly disagree with me, but I would say that gay rights are clearly better in Canada generally than they are in America generally. Do you think that's a fair assessment, first of all?
Oh, yeah, by far.
not just because of marriage, either, I'm saying.
No, yeah, just in general, even how, minor things, and when I say by far, I guess I shouldn't say that much, because it really wasn't that long ago that Canada was where the U.S. is now. Mm. But even in things like, there was, in the States, they recently passed through one of the House stages. I don't know what the actual stages are called there, but this hate crimes amendment where something can be classified as a hate crime now based on sexual orientation. Now, supposedly the president might veto this, but this is something that's been in Canada for a while now. And even when not federally, it was happening, at the provincial levels quite some time ago. You can't fire someone for being gay. You can't, refuse housing because someone's gay. Those kind of things, yeah, it seems that the States is still struggling with, and I don't understand it. I imagine most of your listeners don't really understand it either, but mm-hmm. Yeah, in those kind of respects, I think, yeah, Canada's ahead. That said, I think that I've noticed more as a blogger, reading a lot of American blogs for news on gay rights issues, I think there's this perception that, same-sex marriage is going to be the thing. Once we get that, everything's going to be great. It's full equality. It's not going to be the end of the issue, though. There's always going to be people that are going to try and oppose whatever you're trying to do. People are going to... I think people maybe should be looking more toward Canada kind of for the future direction. Maybe what we've done in the past because it was successful as far as getting those results. But also, there's probably some mistakes that were made, and they're still causing issues here. And, for anyone struggling with gay rights, I think looking at Canada is a good kind of glimpse into the future, so to speak, of what other countries are going to be dealing with. Hmm. And I think, maybe there shouldn't be so much emphasis on same-sex marriage, which, of course, is very, very important. But, that's not going to be the end of the struggle. And it's one of those things that's a huge step. But yeah.
Well, I think that's true because, it's all very well and good to say that marriage should be equal, and I, of course, think it should be, but it doesn't help people if they still face discrimination in employment and housing and face violence in the streets and those kinds of things, because most of the gay and lesbian people in the U.S. have little or no protections at all. Even some of the states, my home state of Illinois, had a few pockets of protections for gay and lesbian people, but it was only within their town borders. Chicago ultimately did pass their human rights ordinance while I still lived there, and that gave protection, housing, and employment and things, but only within the city, and the city, frankly, didn't have jurisdiction in a lot of areas. So even a statewide measure, although it's an improvement, doesn't help. What really is needed in the U.S. is a national protection. But that actually, as you probably know, created a whole controversy recently when an openly gay member of Congress, Barney Frank, decided to drop transgender protections from the bill in order to try to get it passed. How are transgender people treated in Canada?
You know, probably not. Legally, I think it's the same as gay people. I think maybe in society, I think there is more discrimination. And it's kind of hard for me to gauge because, especially in Alberta, I didn't know any transgendered people. I should say I don't even know any here, but I can see them. Montreal is more open in that sense. It's a very, very, I don't want to use the word tolerant because it sounds like people are just kind of, I don't know, I'm losing my train of thought, but it's a much more open city.
Yeah.
Alberta, I can't even say how they were treated because it's just, I never really saw any visibility. So certainly they must have felt very uncomfortable. And, you know, I did in Calgary too. And, you know, I'm not transgendered. I still felt, you know, it wasn't the kind of place where I could hold hands in public and do that kind of thing. But also I should mention kind of more in the general gay rights topic, having laws is one thing that says you can't fire someone or you can't evict someone for being gay. But I'm not sure if that always kind of translates into practice.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things that if someone is annoyed by gay people for any reason, you know, they can fire them and then say, oh, but it's not because you're gay. It's because... And then, you know, list any number of reasons why someone could be fired. Now, the problem is, I'm sure for every employee, there's going to be one or two little things that you can bring to the attention of anyone that says, oh, this is why you should be fired. You were, I don't know, late one day, or this other employee doesn't like you. You know, you can always kind of invent these reasons.
Yeah.
And it's stuff like that that still happens here. Maybe not so much in the workplaces. Definitely, I find with religious organizations, and I think that's where a lot of this clashing is going. And it's kind of a touchy topic because I don't, you know, I believe everyone should have their freedom of religion. I don't necessarily think that freedom really involves refusing services to gay people. And you're seeing a lot of cases like that now in Canada where a civil marriage commissioner, who is just someone licensed by the government to perform a marriage ceremony, some of them have refused to marry gay couples. Because they say, you know, it's against their religious freedom. In that case, I think it's more of their job. They're, you know, they have this license from the government to issue this document and to officially, you know, put their signature on it. And I don't think you should be able to refuse your job to anyone.
Well, these civil marriage commissioners, are they government employees or are they sort of like private contractors?
This is kind of the tricky part. They're not actually government employees. They provide a service on behalf of the government because you could always go to, say, a Justice of the Peace. Now, I should mention that Justice of the Peace is a government employer, or at least a municipal one. And even they have been, there's been, I think, one or two cases where they've refused to you know, put their stamp on the paper. And, you know, that's kind of an issue, and it even gets more kind of into a gray area. I just did a story recently. There's this conference. It was a church-sponsored conference on social justice, and there's a Catholic peace activist who was actually kidnapped and held hostage in Iraq for quite some time. It made international news. He was eventually rescued, which is wonderful, and brought back to Canada, where it was then revealed that he was gay. And he had to keep that secret throughout his entire captivity because he certainly would have been executed for that. I think one of his colleagues actually was executed while there, which is very sad. But since then, I mean, he's, you know, been kind of in the spotlight for a while, and he's been doing a lot of talks. And there's been more than one occasion where his talk was canceled because it was a church-sponsored event, and they can't get over the fact that he's gay. You know, even though he's not going to be talking about anything on that subject, I think it's just going to be more on his peace activism. And I think his last speech was supposed to be on pacifism. And it was canceled. The church basically, or I think it was the archbishop in this case, was lobbied by a right-wing group who called the speaker an unrepentant, active homosexual or something like that. And so they got all this organization to start lobbying the archbishop, who then said, yeah, we're canceling him. But again, the archbishop was carefully said, oh, but no, it's not because he's gay. It's because this article he wrote 7 years ago, or however many years ago, where it mentions that he disagreed with something in the church. And he said, oh, we can't have a speaker talking about that. And, you know, I think these are the kind of things. You have laws. And I should mention, religious organizations are exempt from these laws. They can choose to cancel whoever they want, just based on the fact that they're a religious organization. But, you know, even in other places, this is the kind of process that still goes on where you can say, you know, oh, you're fired. But no, not because you're gay. It's because of this other little thing that I spent, you know, a few hours researching after the fact.
Yeah. Well, that, pardon me. That's often the case where employers or what have you will find ways of getting around laws that they don't agree. But I think you're right, and I think that the larger issue is changing the underlying attitudes, I suppose you could say, so that they don't try to go down that road anymore. The religious exemption was also an issue in the U.S. as well, because Bush's spokespeople said that he would veto the so-called gay rights bill if it ever reached his desk, because it didn't have enough religious protections. Religious organizations were already exempted, but he said it didn't go far enough, which... I mean, I've blogged about this, and I've talked about it on the podcast as well. I think that attempting to compromise with wingnuts is pointless, because they will never come to a compromise. It's their way or no way. And I personally think that the way forward, certainly for America, is to concentrate on trying to get people elected to office who will do the right thing rather than these nutcases.
But yeah, no, exactly. It was the same thing here, you know, during this whole marriage debate, which went forever. I mean, you know, it was always about, oh, religions aren't protected, we need to add this and this and this. And basically the government, who was a liberal minority at the time, was constantly accused of fast-tracking this bill through to give same-sex marriage to all of Canada. It had already been granted even, I think, retroactively since 2001 in some provinces, but all over Canada it wasn't. And there was always these accusations that you're fast-tracking it, you're putting it through too fast. You haven't even considered the consequences of religious this and that. You know, this debate, the first time someone in Canada tried to get a same-sex marriage was in the 70s. And, you know, since then, you know, slowly built momentum. And then when they put the bill before Parliament, it had been years and years. There were delays while the bill was referred to the Supreme Court to answer a few questions on whether or not it was consistent with our Charter of Rights, which is like the U.S. Constitution. Mm. There's a few differences. And the Supreme Court said, yes, it's okay. You know, delay after delay, and it was debated and debated and debated for years, but there's still... Yeah, no, and I think that's what it boils down to is, you know, right-wing groups will just never be happy. And I think as long as you try to engage them in this debate and say, well, okay, well... you know, get more religious stuff in, they're just, it's not going to be enough until eventually it's their way and that's it.
Yeah, it always seems to be an either-or proposition, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Which actually I think is one of the things that you often point out in SLAP, and very well, I might add. And I'm thinking in particular about the way that you'll show up the, how do I want to put it? Not the stupidity exactly, but the empty-headed thinking of some of these people. And I'm thinking in particular of the point-counterpoint you did about Dumbledore being gay in the Harry Potter series. And I'm going to put a link in the show notes to that particular post as well. But the thing that I thought was so funny about it is you pointed, quoted this woman, Christian activist, what was her name? Laura Mallory. Going on and on and on about how terrible it was. And then you have Dumbledore giving the counterpoint just saying, I'm fictional.
Yeah, no, and, you know, I almost wish I kind of waited for that story, because there was a columnist in the National Post who ended up writing two articles about this, and she's kind of a right-wing, you know, going on and on about how, you know, outing Dumbledore is such a big deal, like kids don't need to know about this, and it's only about sex, and, you know, why bother revealing that, and two articles on this, and I can't wrap my head around why, you know, this isn't something, especially like J.K. Rowling, you know, didn't plan this as a publicity stunt. You know, someone asked a question. I think it was something like, you know, has Dumbledore ever fell in love? And then she mentioned it was some other male character.
Yeah.
You know, as the answer to a question and this uproar, I don't get it.
Do you have conservative commentators who have a national following?
In Canada? No, I really don't think we do. You know, there's a few well-known commentators, and I think they're kind of all more centrist. It depends on the issue. But no, nothing like Bill O'Reilly, where it's almost to the point where it's just all theatrics, where it's, you know, facts don't even matter. It doesn't matter showing both sides of the story. It's, you know, you present everything as facts. And
yeah.
I don't really think we have anything like that. Now, in the newspapers, we do. I would say editorialists are far more apt to kind of go along those lines of reasoning and that kind of presentation. But it's almost always balanced, even within the same paper, you know, as someone on the opposite end of the spectrum or someone maybe not even the opposite ends, because then you just kind of get this back and forth with no compromise. But it ends up being more of a legitimate discussion. So I'm a little more happy with that. It depends on the newspaper, though, too. Like here, the National Post is a very right-wing paper. The Globe and Mail is more left-leaning. So depending on which one you read, you're going to get more of one side than the other.
Mm.
But there's nothing, yeah, quite O'Reilly-like. Although I have to enjoy that he calls it the no-spin zone.
As if.
Yeah. It's like, well, oh, good. I don't have to investigate that anymore.
I talked before, I was asking before about Canada's image in the world and traveling with the little patch and all that sort of things, but what I'd like to know is if there's anything that you wish Americans understood about Canada.
Maybe that the States isn't always better. I tend to get this perspective, or I don't know, this perception, I guess is what I want to say, that whenever I'm talking to someone that's from the States, there's this lot of emphasis on how great the States are, at least in their education. They have Pledge of Allegiance to their flag, and, you know, it's the land of the free, and everything's possible here, and I think that's kind of too ingrained, and that it'd be nice every now and then, and I don't want to, you know, blanket all Americans with the statement. There are definitely some ones that have a little more worldly perspective.
Mm.
But, you know, other places are different. They're not necessarily worse, and, you know, I'm not going to say that Canada's better. I don't believe that. It's you know, there are going to be good things about either country, and there's going to be kind of bad things. And, yeah, no, there's, maybe it's just me, but I do get that perception that, you know, it's the state. Everyone wants to be the States. Everyone wants to travel to the States. And if you're not there, it's just because you're not as fortunate, you know, and I kind of wish maybe that horizon would be expanded a little.
Mm. Well, I'm glad you said that, because that's one of the themes that I've been returning to again and again on my podcast and in my blog, because sometimes it's not that I feel defensive exactly, but I feel I sometimes have to go out of my way to explain something that sounds to American ears abhorrent. And I have to admit that when I first arrived in New Zealand, some of the things I encountered, at first I was like, what? A good example of that is what is here called censorship, but it doesn't mean what Americans think of when they hear that phrase. It's got to do with classification of film and literature, and to keep harmful material out of the hands of children primarily, and also a rating system that means something and is independent of the film industry, unlike America. But I always feel compelled, censorship is a good example, I always feel compelled to point out that America does have censorship. It's just done in more subtle ways, like the film rating code, for example, which is done by the industry.
Yeah. And I find, because I think I see that difference too, where free speech is the most important thing in the States, it seems like. People are always talking about that, and you can't infringe upon that in any way. But that already doesn't exist in certain legal aspects. You know, I can't go up and just say something horrible about a politician without facing severe legal consequences, or, you know, saying that the head of the CEO is a child molester, or the head of this organization, or something.
Mm.
You know, there's libel and issues like that. And in Canada, we have hate speech laws. You can't go and, you know, say that I think all of this minority group should be put to death. That will get you, you know, at the very least severe fines. I don't think it's ever happened, but I think it could get you jail time as well. And I've actually seen people in the States arguing. There was a Canadian, her name is, what's her name? Don Stefanowicz. Who went, and I saw a little clip on YouTube of her talking in the States about something about gay marriage and saying how in Canada we're not allowed to discuss this because they don't allow discussion. So I'm very thankful that you're letting me discuss same-sex marriage here. And, you know, it's utter nonsense. She was yelling her head off while she was here about all of that stuff. But, you know, that said, I don't think there's any difference between, you know, libel against a corporation or an individual and against an entire minority group. And I get that feeling whenever I mention that Canada has hate speech laws, that just seems like the most taboo thing in the world for Americans when I mention that.
Absolutely. One of the best-known gay blogs in the U.S. is Joe My God out of New York City. And he was mentioning it recently. Essentially, what they're doing in the U.S. is they're trying to attach it to other bills, and they call it the Matthew Shepard Act. And they're trying to attach it as an amendment to, say, defense bills, for instance. And the bill is very similar to what you're saying. It just criminalizes specific hate speech. But what the right-wing Christianist churches have been doing is going around saying that it will make it impossible for them to talk about their moral viewpoint on homosexuality in general. Which is, of course, a load of nonsense.
And again, it's one of those things that Canada just went through this not that long ago, and it was the same arguments over and over again. And we're finding, you know, there are little situations where maybe there's a clash that's not entirely clear. It's certainly not as extreme as the right-wing groups are trying to make it seem, where, you know, a priest is going to be jailed for mentioning that the Bible says homosexuality is a sin.
Yeah,
you know, that doesn't happen. That's already protected. It was protected for a long, long time in Canada. I think it's probably the same thing in the States. You know, there are going to be little situations that pop up now and then, but they're the kind of things that get resolved, too. You know, it's people aren't, you know, like blind lemmings that follow every, you know, the law to the very letter when a gray area comes up. You know, people are going to bring up these discussions again. Well, what should we do in this case? And I think dealing with them on a case-by-case basis, as long as that general protection is there, is good. You know, I think hate speech laws are important because I think it really does have an effect on the actions of people, and certainly the attitudes. You know, if you can say whatever you want about groups, no matter, you know, how horrible, whatever you're calling for violence and hatred, you know, you can say, okay, sticks and stones, but in practice, I don't think that really happens. I think, you know, violence really does start to come out of that because you're in an environment where that kind of thing could be fostered.
Yeah. And there is a profound difference between just saying that homosexuals are immoral and are going to hell and saying homosexuals are immoral and going to hell and they all should be murdered. There's
a
huge difference between those.
And, that's exactly it.
And as you were pointing out, essentially, freedom of speech is not absolute. There are certain things that cannot be said. And the famous analogy is that you can't shout fire in a crowded movie theater. But there are others as well. And in the U.S., one of the criteria was that if it presented a clear and present danger, it wasn't legal. But you're absolutely right when you talk about people in the U.S. tending to perceive the First Amendment guaranteeing free speech as if it had been handed down as the 11th commandment from God himself. And it's just not true.
Yeah, and you know, I don't want to make it sound, I do think free speech is extremely important.
Absolutely.
You know, when calling for violence and outright hatred for, I mean, especially with, there are some people that they're very, very set in their ways and they're not going to, you know, say these things to start a discussion. They're just going to be, you know, spewing out his points with nothing really to back it up other than, you know, just stating everything as fact. And, you know, I think that's dangerous. And free speech, I don't think it's the same. You don't have the freedom to spew hate speech. And that's, you know, that's my standpoint. I do think it is important to be able to criticize the government and all those things that freedom of speech was originally, you know, put in the U.S. Constitution for, and the Canadian one as well. But I think that's kind of where it goes, is you should never be jailed for criticizing the government. You should be able to say anything as long as it's not harming anyone or, you know, inciting other people to harm someone.
Yeah. There's a controversy in New Zealand at the moment because there's an archaic law that's still on the books. And I'm just trying to think, I just totally spaced out on what it's called. Essentially what it amounts to is treason. It's not treason, though. It's a different manner. And it was used not so very long ago. A man is sort of a troublemaker. He's not political necessarily, but in this particular case, he took an axe and put it through the window of the electorate office of the prime minister. And it was to make some sort of point. I don't even remember what the point was supposed to be. Sedition, that's what it's called. It's sedition laws. And he was convicted and sent to prison for it. But Parliament is getting ready to repeal it because it's a 19th century law, and it was designed to prevent rebellion. But their point is that once you start talking about sedition, and the U.S. used to have similar laws, once you start talking about sedition, it starts to cross that line into suppressing legitimate political free speech. And so they I mean, here in New Zealand, the government is saying, look, there are plenty of existing laws to deal with people who are violent. You don't need that. But then they just turned around and they also increased the penalties for terrorism. They've made terrorism itself a criminal offense, whereas before it would be sort of an aggravating factor. Is terrorism a big issue in Canada?
You know, it was for a while. I think we do have an official... I don't know what it's called. It's definitely not the Minister of Terror, but it's... but there is someone that that is always kind of on the guard about security, and this is certainly after the attacks in the United States in 2001. Mm. I think, you know, all over the world, people have been a little more conscious of that.
Yep.
And, you know, and I mean, Canada is in Afghanistan fighting who the actual terrorists were, but I don't really think we're as paranoid about that here. You know, we don't have a color-coded alert system, and,
yeah.
You know, I never have felt unsafe, and I don't think, even though we have this minister that deals with these sort of issues, they're never trying to panic the public or make everyone scared.
Hmm.
And I think that's kind of a big difference. I'm not really even sure, is that still a huge thing in the States? Are they still... I think the color-coded system is still there, but do they still have this atmosphere of fear?
Of course, admittedly, my perspective is a bit skewed because I'm on the other side of the planet, but I mean, I do watch the American network news, primarily ABC, sometimes CBS, and read the newspapers online and those kinds of things. And I it seems to me that the color-coded system has been sort of pushed a bit to the side, although American listeners living in America can certainly... correct me if I'm wrong about that. But what I have noticed is that the Bush administration officials will from time to time still try to bring it up to scare the people into doing something or to not criticize them or not question them. But it just isn't working anymore. Because, I mean, the Bush administration did that time and time again. That's partly how they won the 2004 election, was by trying to scare everybody to death. And not just about terrorism, but also about those very scary homos who want to get married. And they won. Well, sort of.
Yeah. No, but I think you're right in that people are starting to get fatigued from that message. I certainly got that impression here because we've been exposed to, we do get a lot of American media up in Canada. And although I didn't fully understand a lot of it, I mean, you know, we were legitimately scared when the attacks had took place. And, you know, we are concerned about security, but there was never this atmosphere of fear in Canada quite like there is in the States. And watching the media from an outside perspective was really kind of spooky in that sense. But yeah, there was one thing, I wish I could remember the exact quote, but Stephen Harper said something, I think it's a while ago now, it might be a year or a year and a half ago, but he mentioned something about the Liberal Party being soft on terror. And it got a lot of attention, this quote, because it sounded so American. And people were just so tired of this message that, you know... It didn't make any sense either. I mean, what does it mean to be soft on terror? Like, you know, oh, I'll allow terror to happen, you know. Anyway, that kind of message, it seems so out of the ordinary in Canada, but it was something that, you know, just from watching the media in the States, you get that kind of thing all the time, candidates accusing each other of being soft on terror. And yeah.
Mm. There was a case not so very long ago, and I should have looked up his name, but I didn't. I believe he was originally Palestinian or somewhere from the Middle East, and he was transiting through the U.S. I think he was in Boston or somewhere. He was apprehended. He's a Canadian citizen. He was apprehended that's it. Harar. One of the podcasts I listen to is called Democracy Now!, which is a decidedly left-of-center perspective on things. But it said that his final return to Canada was big news in Canada, and Canada was following the story quite carefully. First of all, was that really true? Was Canada following the story and the developments?
It is true, yeah. In fact, he ended up getting an official apology from our government. I'm not entirely sure what for. And this is, I just have to bring this up because it annoys me. Again, when during the apology, Stephen Harper made a jab at the former Liberal government. But he also got quite a bit of money as some kind of settlement.
Yeah.
I don't really know the legal aspects of it, but it definitely was in the news. And I heard that the U.S. isn't apologizing for what happened.
No. Canada's involvement was that they essentially handed him over to the American authorities, who then, and for the benefit of my listeners who don't know the story, he was apprehended and he was taken away from the U.S. in the so-called Extraordinary Rendition Program, which is U.S. government torture program. He was taken to Syria, where he was tortured, and then he was eventually brought back to the U.S., and then ultimately released, all without trial, without charge. The U.S. also refuses to take him off of the no-fly list and the list of terrorists, or suspected terrorists, I think it is. And so he can never come to the U.S. He can't even transit through the U.S., and which actually would make it really dodgy for a Canadian, because if a plane develops engine trouble, chances are they're going to have to come to the U.S. Say a transatlantic flight flying from Canada direct to Europe, if it develops engine trouble, it very well might have to come back to the U.S., which could be a problem for somebody on a no-fly list like that. But as I understand it, the Bush administration was really annoyed with Canada for apologizing and for compensating him, and they're basically digging in their heels, and that's really what it's about on the American side. They're just angry that, you know, how dare Canada defy us on this?
I really don't have much more to add to that, because, well, part of it is I really don't know much of the U.S. perspective. Most of this stuff was from Canada.
Yeah, well, I was just curious if it had been in the news, because Democracy Now! Talked about it and was saying that it had been such a big story. But speaking of people running into trouble with the authorities, you have posted about, pardon me, about a couple of different gay refugees.
Oh, yeah.
Now, do you have any updates on whatever happened to any of them?
You know, not really. And I think that's because at least one of them, Alvaro, who is from Nicaragua, where homosexuality is illegal. I should give some background on the story, maybe.
Yeah.
He, at least this is his story. I don't want to present it as fact. He was beaten by his father for being gay. And there's, because homosexuality is illegal, you can be jailed, or even just worse from the general public. So he escaped at a very young age. I think it was 12 or 13. Ended up swimming across some channel to the States, where he slowly made his way up to Canada, and has been living here for a while. And while he was up here, he figured he'd try and get citizenship based on the fact that he's now openly gay and can't go to Nicaragua because it's, you know, he's going to be persecuted. Well, his adjudicator didn't believe that he was gay. She said that because he wasn't pursuing relationships while he was in the States, and he, you know, that there was no evidence that he was gay, and she ordered him to be deported from Canada. Now, I mean, he left home when he was like 12 or 13, and he would have been in his teens all while going throughout the States. He's still relatively young now. I think he's 17 or 18, 19, somewhere around there. So, you know, to say, oh, you weren't having sex when you were 14, therefore you're not gay, seems really, really odd to me. And this whole case is so unusual in that the refugee board is just refusing to hear any more about this case. And for every appeal that he made, you know, with these legitimate arguments of, well, now, you know, they've been Canada and he's out, even, you know, going back, the story has been picked up by the media in his home country.
Really?
So it's an odd deal, and they're just, they are determined to deport him, and his deportation date was actually on the 4th of this month, and I haven't heard anything since, so I'm pretty sure he's just gone into hiding. Some of the other stories I really haven't heard much on either. There is another case where I think it's going to be even a little trickier, because, oh, and I can't remember where he's from, but homosexuality isn't illegal there, but there's still a lot of discrimination there, but he's still trying to make the same kind of argument. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, if Alvaro didn't make it here, this guy isn't either, and it's really kind of unfortunate, especially when they're using that kind of logic. It just makes no sense to me.
Yeah, we actually had a fairly similar case in some ways here with a gay Iranian who was granted asylum, which essentially in New Zealand, that just means you get permanent residence. You still have to go through the normal process to later become a citizen if you so choose. But the idea behind being designated a refugee is that you can stay indefinitely until theoretically the situation in your homeland improves, or you just decide to give up and become a citizen here. But the Christian right was just frothing about it, that this guy had been granted refugee status, and they said it was political correctness run amok and all that kind of thing. But what was really getting their knickers in a twist was that at the same time there was a Christian Iranian, I think he was Iranian, who was applying for asylum, and he was being rejected. And they said that if he, because he had been Muslim, if he went back, he'd be executed because Iran and other hardline Islamic states do execute people for converting from Islam to another religion. That is punishable by death in states that follow Islamic law. But I think it sounds like the case that this guy is facing, the Christian guy is facing, is sort of similar to the gay guy in Canada, in that he's hasn't presented enough evidence that he would be facing problems if he went back, or they don't necessarily believe his conversion is legitimate. I'm not exactly sure. But it's kind of interesting how it's sort of like the opposite here, where a gay refugee is believed and is given asylum, whereas one who isn't hasn't been given the asylum.
Yeah, no, and it really is the opposite, because we had a case, too, where there was actually a convicted criminal who was about to be deported, but he was in the midst of a religious conversion. He was converting to, I don't know, Christianity, or I think it was Christianity. And a judge said, oh, well, we can put a stay on your deportation and cancel it because you're in the middle of this conversion. And in the meantime, these, you know, you can't prove you're gay, so therefore, bye. You know, and it's, you know, what can I say? It seems very un-Canada-like. It's very different from the rest of our laws, and it doesn't make an awful lot of sense to me.
Yeah. Well, then in general, how would you describe Canada to maybe people who don't know much about it? That's a big question, I realize.
Well, culturally, it's very similar to the States, maybe not so much in my province now, Quebec, which is it looks very European. The culture, I mean, it's obviously a French culture, but not in the European French sense. It's a very unique culture. I can't really see myself living anywhere else, or I shouldn't say that, because never's a long time.
And
I do like other places. But I really like it here, is I guess what I want to say. You know, it's not, there's problems with anywhere. It's, you know, I'm not trying to paint this as perfect utopia where everyone should move here right now. But it's, yeah, I don't know. That's a loaded question. What can I say? I like it. It's different from the States. It's different from everywhere. It's in its own country. I like it. I don't know what to say.
Well, actually, reminding people that it's his own country is probably a good place to start.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of interesting. One of the reasons I ask that is because I sometimes get asked that as well. Because my perspective is a little bit different because I've only just been here 11 years. It's actually my 12th anniversary is, well, my anniversary is always on November 2nd, but my 12th anniversary is just November 2nd. And so my perspective is a little bit different. It's trying to explain to friends and family back in, well, not them so much, but people back in America about what it's like. And since I've been here for a long time, I'm sort of like, well, what do you mean? What is it like? It's like home. But that's interesting. Well, I think we should probably wrap this up. We've been talking for quite a while now. But I'd like to thank you very much for being on my podcast. And I'd certainly like to encourage everybody to go visit Slap Upside the Head. And I'm going to put a link in the show notes, of course. And there's always one on my blog. You can always find it it's listed under Blogs I Read, if I remember correctly. But thanks again, Mark, and it's been great talking with you.
Yeah, no, and thanks for having me, and thanks again for writing that guest article you did for Slap while I was away.
Oh, yeah, that was the first one of those I ever did.
Yeah, no, thanks. I really appreciated it because I was gone. I wasn't too sure what I was going to do with the site. And also, listeners probably don't know this, but I made you jump through a ton of hoops to even just get this conversation because I don't use Skype and I don't use AIM or any of this stuff, so I made you get a Jabber account and talking on iChat, so thanks for going through all that.
Oh, I was determined. Okay, well, thanks, and we'll have to talk again soon.
Okay.
That's it for this episode. Be sure to visit Mark's site at slapupsidethehead.com. There's a link on my blog, and of course I'll put one in the show notes. I'll be back on Friday with another episode, but in the meantime, if you'd like to leave a comment, you can ring my listener line at 206-339-8413, or you can leave a comment on my blog, amrins.com, and you can always send me an email at amrins@yahoo.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'll be back on Friday. Bye.